Hey everybody, welcome back to the Treatment Free Beekeeping Podcast. Today is episode 50. Can you believe it? 50 episodes. I just went back and looked when I started. The first episode came out July 13th, 2014. It's been almost 3 years. 50 episodes. It's been great. I've got to talk to a lot of really interesting people and some boring people. No, I'm kidding. None of these was boring. Not a single one has not been worth my time. It has always been interesting. Thank you to all the guests that I've had on so far, some of them multiple times, and undoubtedly more will be on multiple times in the future. I know I'm trying to get Jason Bruns on even again, even though he's already been on this year already. So there will be repeat guests, and I thank you to those, and those of you who have been on in the past and maybe have especially new beekeepers who now have a couple of years under their belt. If you'd like to come back on the show and talk about your beekeeping experience thus far, and especially if you want to relate that to the to your original episode, just get in contact with me and we'll get you back on here and it'll be fun. Today's show is with Kay Ruby Bloom. She goes by Ruby. That was a fun episode. It's the second episode that I've done in person here on the podcast. In the first episode, we actually packed up all the equipment and hauled it out to her place, which is out in north of Grants Pass, Oregon here. I think, what is the name of that town? Anyway, it's out there. I'm sure I mentioned it in the podcast. So it was really fun to go out and see her little ranch there, and I got lots of pictures that she sent along. We'll talk about some feral hives that she has in her barn. We'll talk about her Waray hives, her top bar hives, her experience moving from the Bay Area to here. Lots of stuff. It was really just a great joy to go out and visit her, take a field trip, get to see her little farm ranch thing out there. And great for the 50th episode. And it's a good long one too. We got well over an hour. So pay attention to that. It's coming up after this commercial break. I'm just kidding. I'm just going to plug the Patreon page again here, because today's show is brought to you by the patrons at patreon.com/TFB. If you would like to support the podcast or support treatment-free beekeeping education in general, go to patreon.com/TFB, sign up to be a monthly patron, and you too can support this thing and make sure that it stays here and keep me motivated to get this thing done. Since we've switched to a monthly billing, I did lose quite a bit of my monthly revenue. So, looking to get some more people on board, but because of that, you got three episodes last month. Normally you would only get two and you got three. Why did you get three? Because I didn't feel like I could only bill for two episodes. Like, I can just give the stuff to you because I have the stuff. And in fact, as I'm recording this right now, this is episode 50. I have already recorded episode 51 and 52. And I hope to publish I do solemnly swear and promise, etc., to publish those episodes this month. So you're going to get another three this month. And if I can get off my tuchus, I can publish a couple of videos that I have saved up too. So there's lots of stuff and it's all coming to you. So sign up and become a patron. All the other links, I mention the links so often. You all know where the Facebook group is. If you haven't found the Facebook group, check that out. If you do have the opportunity, please go to iTunes and leave me a generally positive review. I'm told that it helps get more people, you know, get it up on the list and get more people listening. So that's good also. Got about 3,000 listeners to each episode these days, so that's doing pretty good. But hey, let's get it up to 100,000. Oh, that's probably asking too much. Oh, well. All right, so here we go. Ruby coming up after the theme song. Ruby, welcome to the podcast. Remind me of how I met you. It was on the Facebook group, right?
Yeah, I finally found you and joined the group, and you welcomed me, and I put a little introduction up on there about myself and was stoked to find such a large group of treatment-free beekeepers.
Yeah, I've been totally surprised about how, I say this over and over and over again, I've been totally surprised about how much it's caught on and how popular it's become.
Yeah, well, I was particularly impressed because before I joined, I went and read your guidelines, because you have your intro at the top saying, oh, I had to, delete some of the conversations because they were really off topic. And so here's our guidelines. And I read the guidelines and I was like, yeah, I really like that. Somebody expressed this really eloquently and straightforward so that anyone can understand. And with your permission, I might, and credit, I might reprint some of it on my website.
Sure. All of my stuff is totally free. The podcast is totally free. You can listen to everything. All my websites and everything's totally free to access. I have nothing behind a paywall. And that's part of what, with the podcast, I've had several speakers say that they didn't want me to charge for it. And I said, no, that's fine. I don't.
Okay.
The just a little backstory behind the guidelines on the Facebook group is that it's really, I wanted to make it clear that the Facebook group is for people who want to talk about treatment-free beekeeping and not,
it's argue not, for it or for or about.
Right. And it's not where you would come to try and argue for or against it or be argued or be convinced. It's if you want to do this thing, you come to here and we can talk about it. It's not. And a lot of people really don't get that, and that's unfortunate. I wish they were better, but I mean, it's part of life.
Understood.
Because I've been in lots of groups in the past where someone wants to ask a question about treatment-free beekeeping, and they get 18 replies about how you shouldn't, how you should treat your bees, and it's just not that much fun.
Understood. I know. I have Michael Bush's book, and I love Michael, and he's helped me out lots of times. And I was surprised, you know, for someone who was already treatment-free, I've been a beekeeper for 20 years, and I would say for 19 and three quarters, I've been treatment-free. I didn't really need all of the convincing from him. I appreciated it, and I appreciated the struggles that he's gone through to try to convince people that alternative hive systems have their place and that treatment-free practices have their place. But it's nice to just go someplace where you don't have to slog through all that, and you can just talk about your bees and the way that, and some other things about them that's interesting, and maybe just the joy that comes from hanging out with them.
Well, I mean, I think of it like reading a book. Like, you read a book about, say, beekeeping or anything else, you don't want the book to start out by telling you you shouldn't be a beekeeper. You want to read about beekeeping. It's the same thing with the Facebook group. You want to read about treatment-free beekeepers. You want to see what other beekeepers are doing like you or different, you know, get ideas from them. And we can have some spirited discussion sometime, but it's all within a context.
Yeah.
So how did you, I'm looking at your lovely ranch out here and your dogs and your fruit trees I can see out there and the barns and stuff. Give me the whole backstory behind this. I'm really interested. Because this is like my dream.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not there right now, but this is my dream.
So we're not sure yet if this is our dream, but we're trying it out. I've only been here 6 months. For the past 20 years, I have, or longer, I live my entire life minus 2 years probably in the San Francisco Bay Area. Mm-hmm. I was born at Stanford. I grew up in Berkeley. I spent my young adulthood in San Francisco and my mid-adulthood in Oakland. And let's see how I can make this story digestible. So before I did what I do now, I ran a giant puppet theater for 10 or 15 years.
Really?
And was a working artist and did a lot of art activism and art for social change. And I did that until I thought that I would barf if I ever saw another bucket of wheat paste. I was so burnt out and tired and exhausted. And, you know, try to make your living as an artist. And so I took some time off and decided to just follow my bliss. And what that turned out to be was plants. I'm a confirmed plant geek. I have grown every kind of plant except for maybe one that's very popular here in Southern Oregon.
So that one you haven't grown.
What?
That one you haven't grown.
My parents grew it. But I have not personally. I've grown just about everything else, all annual and perennial vegetables, medicinal herbs, culinary herbs, succulents, roses, dahlias, flowers, fruit trees, berries, everything possible. I've studied native plants. I've studied botany. So when I was recovering from my art job, I took some time off to do what I wanted, and that was study plants and become a gardener. And I had a large double lot in urban Oakland. And I went to a do-it-yourself Skillshare one day, and some friend of mine said, "Hey, Ruby, I hear you have a large lot. Could we put a beehive there?" And I had never really thought about bees. I didn't spend my childhood going, "Oh, I want to be a beekeeper." Sorry. But I was open. And so they came over that week and dropped off this really odd looking box that looked nothing like what I think a beehive, or at that time what I thought a beehive looked like. It was long, and they said, "This is a Kenyan top bar hive." This was in 1996. So at that time, it wasn't like today. You could not go online and buy a top bar hive. I mean, you couldn't go online at all, really, at that point, or barely. It was a real do-it-yourself system. And so they dropped this box off, and I said, "Oh, you know, I love learning stuff. Can I be around when you manage it?" And they said, "Yeah, sure." And so, you know, scheduling aside, I got to do that with them a couple times, and then they just disappeared, leaving this box of bees on my property. So I went out and got the only book. I downloaded the only book on top bar beekeeping at that time, Small Scale Beekeeping by Curtis Gentry. You can still find it online. And he had been part of a project to take a very old system, the top bar hive is very old, and develop it for cottage industry in Africa, specifically in Kenya, although it was also used in Tanzania. Anyway, so that book was there. I read the book, and I became a beekeeper. Now, 20 years later, I still consider myself a beginner, maybe an advanced beginner at this point. But I've been teaching beekeeping for 10 years, specifically with alternative hive systems, and I still don't quite know what I'm doing. I shouldn't say that, should I? No, I would say the bees still don't quite know what I'm doing. The only other thing I would say is that after a few years, I did end up starting a school called the Institute of Urban Homesteading, and taught urban agriculture skills, including natural beekeeping with alternative hive systems. And I did that the last 10 years in Oakland, and I simply grew out of my 10th of an acre. So some women get the biological, "I've got to have a baby." I got the biological, "I've got to have a farm." Mm. And so I just, last summer I went on a road trip and I got discouraged in Northern Oregon. There wasn't anything available. And I got down here to Grants Pass and saw this property and was like, "Okay, I'm going to grab it." And so here I am.
Yeah, this is a great spot out here in Merlin. I grew up over in Rouge. You familiar with Rouge?
Oh, yeah. I have some friends over there.
Yeah. And I mean, we came over here to Wildlife Images several times when I was growing up. Mm-hmm. You're just a few miles down from Wildlife Images. That's kind of cool. This is a nice little kind of isolated valley, kind of up northwest of Grants Pass. Great little area back here.
We're in a little crook of the Rogue, and it is nice. I like that it's low density people-wise. Sometimes it's hard because it seems like Williams and the Applegate are the center of the universe, and it's kind of a drive. But we're working on creating a little niche of cool community over here in West Grants Pass, and there's some neat stuff going on. And yeah, in terms of just pure beauty, it's beautiful here. I will admit, you know, I've been a Bay Area beekeeper for 20 years. I know a lot about the seasons and how to be a beekeeper there. Mm-hmm. And so
you've got some things to learn.
Yeah, and I'm also really hands-off in my beekeeping, so I'm going to assume, as I always do, that the bees know what they're doing. And
you've only been here for 6 months, so you really haven't seen a summer.
Well, I came up in the summer, and the summer is when I bought the property. Mm-hmm. So we were here in July and August, and so I know it's hot.
It's hot and dry, and I don't know how it is out here. It's a little rainier, I think, over here than where I am. But where I am where I grew up in Roosh, it doesn't rain at all from like April or May till the end of September.
Oh, well, I have to tell you, in the Bay Area, it doesn't often rain from March until October or November.
Really?
Yeah. So so in terms of that, it's a lot wetter here than what I'm used to. What's different here than the Bay Area is that there are real winter temperatures and there are real summer temperatures. Mm. The Bay Area has the coastal influence. Now, right at this spot where I am, we get a lot of influence from the Rogue. So
how far is the river from here?
We could walk there in less than 10 minutes.
Okay, so it's just over...
It's that way. If you kept going down the road, we would come to a boat dock, or you can go through the BLM land.
Right.
We could do that afterwards if you're interested. That'd be great. So we get a lot of that sort of river influence. It's really foggy here in the mornings.
Yes.
A lot of times it'll be foggy here, and I'll drive to Medford, and it'll be sunny in Medford. So
that's actually the reason why my grandparents moved from Grants Pass to Roosh, is because it was so foggy. And they were driving, they were looking for a piece of property because they lived down in the bottoms down by the river.
Mm-hmm.
They used to grow wholesale flowers for flower shops and things. And so they were looking for a new piece of property. They drove out into the Applegate Valley, and it was foggy the whole way from here to there. And then they came to this sunny spot, and there was a for sale sign, and they bought it. And that corner of the valley where my dad still lives is... It maybe gets 1 or 2 days of fog a year, whereas the rest gets a whole lot more.
Yeah, I think I like the fog. I don't know how it will be for flowers, but because we like to grow a lot of flowers, but I think in the summer I'll be appreciating it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really, having lived in Arkansas where it's really hot all the time and the temperatures can drop down below zero occasionally in the winter, and having lived in Denver where it's really cold all the time and rarely hot, coming back to Southern Oregon, it's like, this to me is the only place that I would want to live without modern technology like air conditioning and central heating. Like, it's just so much.
You haven't lived in the Bay Area. It's really mild there all year. It's lovely. It's just far too crowded.
But before the advent of air conditioning, I don't know why anybody would want to live in Arkansas.
Oh, yeah.
It's terrible. Denver's not so bad, because it's easier to heat than it is to cool, I think. But yeah, Arkansas. Sorry, Casey and my other Arkansas friends. It's way too hot down there. So let's get into beekeeping now. You talked about how you got into beekeeping back down in the Bay Area. So what all hive types do you have? Have you experimented with some other details around there?
Yeah. So I started with a topar hive. That was basically what I did for, I started with a topar hive. I still have topar hives. There are some issues with topars. Particularly in places where it's very cold and hot. So it'll be interesting to see how I adapt. Somewhere in there, maybe around year 6 or 7 of beekeeping, I did a couple seasons in Langstroth hives just to see what all the buzz was about, to see what was different, if I liked it better. I really struggled with the Langs, partly because I'm small, and I just didn't really enjoy having to pick up a super full of honey to get into my brood. I didn't like that you open the top and if the bees aren't calm, that they all just fly out. I didn't like, in retrospect, how much heat and smell loss there is when you open the top of a Langstroth hive. It's very different from a top bar where you only have a small space open at once. And I broke, it's funny because Langstroth beekeepers complain all the time, oh, a top bar, the combs are so fragile and they break all the time. Well, I struggled with the Langstroth frames that once they're in there, all stuck together with propolis, you know, I just couldn't stop from breaking them. Now, I will admit, I think that it's all about what system you learn on. And if you've learned on a certain system, I think you get comfortable with that and you learn the tricks with that.
Oh, yeah.
But so I did that for 2 years. And interestingly, I'm going to keep a Lang this year, and I'll tell you why in a little while. So then about, and the interesting thing about being a top bar beekeeper was at the beginning, I would say for the first 12 years, any non-top bar beekeeper that I met would look down their nose at me and sneer and tell me that I was irresponsible and a bad beekeeper. I even had a student of mine go into a shop in San Francisco, a honey shop, and was shamed by the woman. Now, I've seen responsible and irresponsible beekeeping in every system. I managed some Langstroth hives and rescued them from terrible non-management situations. And, you know, and I've seen some top bar hives that were beautifully managed and some that were also terrible, like, oh, let's just put some slats across a styrofoam cooler and leave it there in the sun. But that said, right? So that was the first years. And then, you know, very slowly top bar beekeeping gained some credibility. And now, of course, there's quite a number of books out there, and it's a much beloved system by lots of backyard beekeepers. About 4 years ago, the Wari Hive came on the scene. Now, of course, that's also an old system. And what amazed me about it was how quickly it caught the people's imagination. And within 1 year of having heard of a Wari, you could buy it commercially, and there is just a really wide following. There are some lovely things about that system, and we can talk more about that too. But so currently, I have a number of top bar hives, a number of Wari hives, and I've just invented a transition hive to transition from Langstroth to top bar, which is something that top bar beekeepers have sort of complained about forever, that there's no way, like the systems are just not compatible with each other. I'm really committed to the alternative hive systems, and I think particularly the Wari hive is wonderful because it's just completely hands-off. It really respects that the bees know what they're doing and allows a really simple way to harvest some honey and manage the bees with very, very little intervention. And it's very similar if you look down into an empty Wari hive to the tree, the trunk of a tree, or the hollow of a tree, which is, you know, one of the things that bees would move into on their own if they were just looking for a place to live. Mm-hmm. The downside of it, of course, is that beekeeping information is so holographic. I was going to say the downside is that you can't look in on them quite as effectively. You have to really learn to monitor at the hive entrance, mm-hmm. which is a great thing to do because it forces you to use your ears and your nose and your eyes in a really different way. But, of course, now you can get Wari hives with movable frames, and Sam Comfort, of course, from Anarchy Apiaries, he uses miniature movable frame Waris as his mating nukes, and so, you know, there's a lot out there. But I would say one of the fun things about the alternative hive systems is that you get to be inventive and sort of make it up as you go and adapt to your own beekeeping style and to the native climate and to lots of stuff like that. That was a long answer. Sorry.
No, that's fine.
I want to say one other thing just, and then we can dive into other stuff. So I've never been a commercial beekeeper. I've mm-hmm. always been a backyard beekeeper. The most hives I manage at one time is 10 to 12. Usually it's more like 6 to 8. In the urban environment, I kept 2 hives at my own property, and everything else I had was spread out in the urban environment. One reason was because my neighborhood probably had the highest density of bees in an urban environment in the entire world. And so there was a lot of competition for food. So I tried to spread it out. Now that I'm here rural, I don't really know yet what my property can sustain and how many bees I want to have and whether I'm, you know, going to be more than a hobbyist backyard beekeeper or not.
Well, I there's so many things you're saying that I'm really identifying with here. My work is almost completely focused toward backyard beekeepers and beginners.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I've been this latest series talking on the podcast series. I mean, like this last couple of months, the episodes that I've been producing have been focused toward alternative hive types.
Cool.
And getting away from the traditional model of like, this is how the commercial beekeepers do it. And they're the experts. Therefore you should also do it this way as well. Because like you say, there's so many more skills that are different, and the goals are different from a commercial beekeeper whose main focus is ultimately money, and it's always going to be money.
Right.
Versus us who do it more for the love of beekeeping or the enjoyment of the hobby, watching the bees. A commercial beekeeper doesn't have time to sit around in a lawn chair next to a hive and just watch a hive. And
right, so I think the most important hive product is joy.
Yeah. Well, you'll hear my sign-off catchphrase here in a little while. But I've been focusing, you know, talking to Jacqueline and Susan. Susan was talking about Skep beehives. Jacqueline, of course, has all of her, she's got Worry and Top Bar, and I think she's got a Langstroth,
too. She's got a Golden Hive, and she's got some tree hives, like log hives from trees, you know, from bee trees that were felled. And she's got a lot of cool stuff there.
And I talked to Heidi Herman in England a few weeks ago about her model is much more hands-off. And so over the years, since I started keeping bees back in 2003, there's always been this among the beekeeping community, and especially the commercial beekeepers, this idea that if you're not like an active manager of your beehives, you're a bee-haver rather than a beekeeper. And I've recently come to the conclusion that that's just fine. Really, the feral hives that we have living out in the woods, they're already not being kept. I mean, it's like beekeeping in a hive without the beekeeper. They're just by themselves, and they're doing fine by themselves, and they're dealing with pests and things by themselves. And so if you want to set up a hive like a log hive or a Worry, something that where you can just get a little bit of honey but not manage it for maximum production, you can do that too and keep bees just for the enjoyment of having bees in the yard. And so I'm trying to get rid of this idea of the bee-haver as a bad thing.
So I have 2 comments. The first one is, it's only in the United States that we have the Langstroth as a dominant system. All over Europe, there's a wide variety of different hive systems.
Oh, yeah.
It's not standardized like it is here. And the Worry hive came out of a period in European history where everybody was developing their own hive and writing a treatise about it. And, you know, Abby Worry just happened to write a whole book. His book is great. It's a little hard to understand the translation, and you have to actually have some beekeeping experience for his book, although David Heath's book is a little bit more understandable. He's the one who translated Worry's book, and he has 2 of his own books out.
David Heath,
H-E-A-F.
Okay.
He has a book on Worry beekeeping.
I'll have links to all these in the show notes
Great.
For those of you listening.
So, but my point is that, you know, why the Langstroth system got adopted here was probably marketing, and that there in Europe, they duked it out and everybody wrote a treatise, and there's still a lot of different hive systems there. And, you know, truthfully, the bees don't care what shape the box is.
They do care when you open it, though.
They do. They do. Now I've forgotten my second point, but that's okay. We'll get back
It'll come. Yeah. So, well, let's talk more about the Waray hives. I haven't had, I probably have a couple of guests that have had Waray hives, but I, in all my 40 whatever episodes, I've never had like a full exploration of the Waray hive.
It's really cool.
So just go at it. Just tell me what you got.
So, the Waray hive is a top bar hive. It's stacking boxes like a Langstroth hive, but it more closely mimics what bees do in nature. So in nature, bees would move into, let's say, a hollow in an oak tree, and they would always start to build at the top. Always. Like, that's one thing that's amazing about bees is, okay, sometimes they do lots of things that we don't understand, but there are certain things that they always do the same. You know, they always fill in a comb before they start building another one in the back of, or wherever. But so they would start at the top and they'd build comb down with their brood close to the bottom and honey and nectar stores above. And they're building down, 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 down. And then during the wintertime, they will eat their way back up through the honey, right? So the Waray works on the same principle. You give them some boxes. They do have little thin top bars on the top of each box, little slats. And they build down, 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 and when they run out of room, you nadir instead of super. So you put a new box underneath. And so throughout the nectar flow and the honey flow, you continue to give them boxes underneath until they stop building. And then the following winter, they're going to eat their way back up through their stores. if it's been a good year, they're never going to eat their way to the honey in the top of the box. That's just, you know, long-term deep storage. So my way of doing, of managing the Waray is that in the spring, whatever they didn't use, I take. So in the spring, I give them a new box at the bottom so they can continue to build, and I take a box of honey off the top. And bees, in my observation, will prefer to eat nectar and pollen or to eat nectar whenever they can. Honey is only for emergency food and long-term storage. So by taking a box of honey off when there's lots of nectar available is not going to mess them up at all. And that's it. Now, the only hard part about a Waray hive is if you have three boxes high and they're all full of bees and honey, it's really hard to nadir. You have to lift that up. So I have a lift that my sweet friend, who's an engineer, built for me. And mine is really fancy. It's built out of aluminum, and it operates on with a driver drill. Mm-hmm. So I just put the driver drill on. I put it into place. I put the driver drill on and go, and it lifts it up, and I slide my box underneath. You can make simpler ones. There's plans online. You can make them out of wood. But so that's the only part, hard part, is that you need to be able to lift up those boxes to slide one underneath. But other than that, you know, it gives the bees a warm, dry place. The walls of the Waray are a little thicker.
What are they made out of?
Wood, usually cedar.
How thick?
A 1 inch.
1 inch? Full 1 inch?
A full 1 inch. Okay. You know, like I never know nominal dimensional, but a full 1 inch. So that gives, you know, more insulation in the winter, more cool, you know, it's more cool in the summer and more warm in the winter for them. It really is a little bit like a tree when you look down into it. It's, the dimensions are also quite a bit smaller than a Langstroth hive. So it's really sort of tall and thin, like the trunk of a tree.
Do you remember the dimensions right offhand?
I just measured it. I think it's 14 by 14.
14 by, yeah. And it's square.
And it's square, yeah. not rectangular. Yeah. And there's a few really reputable companies that build them. You can get them with windows. Mine have windows. I've bought a few. I've been given a few, and I built a few myself. One of the beauties of the alternative hive systems is that you can build them yourself for pennies on the dollar. You know, a topwar hive can cost $25 to build the whole thing. A ware hive, if you get really nice cedar, might be a little more expensive, but I've seen people also just build them out of normal pine or fir and do quite fine. So there's one other thing that's significantly different about a ware box, and that's the quilt. And when you hear about this, you're really confused. What do they mean by a quilt? So you have your stacking rectangular boxes. They're all the same size. And on the top one, you have, instead of a lid, you have a piece of canvas. And sitting on top of that is a box that has a burlap sheet on the bottom, and it holds wood shavings. So, and that sits on top of the canvas cloth, and might be hard to, and then the roof goes on top of that. Mm-hmm. And this quilt box with the shavings in it is magic. It's so magic that I'm going to build one for my Langstroth hive, and I'm going to build one for all my topbar hives now that I'm here in Southern Oregon. What it does is it insulates and ventilates. So one of the problems in topbar hives is condensation because we don't have the inner cover and the telescoping cover. So it deals with that. It it saps up any moisture that's in the hive. It ventilates the hive, and yet it insulates it as well. It's very simple technology, but it works brilliantly. And so there's no reason why you can build a quilt box for any hive, actually. But, you know, it's basically insulation, but breathable insulation.
Does that stay on year-round?
Yep, it does. The only thing you change, and I haven't done this, but I'll probably do it because in the Bay Area, you really don't need to. There's warm way and cool way. And so you can either have your combs in line with the door or parallel to the door.
Mm-hmm.
And so parallel to the door is called warm way, or is it called cold way? I get that mixed up, but it's the winter way.
Mm-hmm.
So because it doesn't let air flow through the combs. Okay. And parallel with the door is the other way, where you'd have it in the summer so that more airflow can flow through. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so a Langstroth hive is the typical Langstroth hive is what you would call cold way because it's got the combs.
Correct.
Going in, and so each comb has access to that air coming in.
Exactly.
The bottom, whereas if you turn it the other way, the air doesn't only really hits that first comb first.
Right. So that would be one additional management thing in a place where you have a really big temperature differential between summer and winter, like here, is you might lift your whole box and switch. All you would have to do is move the bottom board,
mm-hmm,
90 degrees clockwise or counterclockwise, and you'd be switching from one way to the other way.
I have seen somebody a while back, I forget who it was, but there was one beekeeping supply company that was making a sideways entrance for Langstroth hives.
Interesting.
But I haven't seen it in years and years. Well, but it can be done.
I wanted to mention that, so one of the things I was excited about when I got here was that I would be able to purchase some bees from Old Soul. I've heard about their breeding program all the way from down in California and wished I could buy their bees. It is, you cannot, and I don't even know if they're treatment free.
They're not.
They're not. No suppliers are, and it's tragic. I mean, you really have to breed your own bees and make your own splits. But still, they have a great breeding program, and they only sell their bees in nukes. And because of that, you can't fit a Langstroth nuke into a topbar hive or a ware hive without doing a cutout. And a cutout is incredibly invasive for the bees. And I just don't want to do it.
It's very stressful, yeah.
It's super stressful. And it's messy. And, you know, I've done it. I've adapted, you know, I've cut combs from one top bar system to another to make it fit because they're not standardized. And that's gone okay. But anyway, so I decided that I was going to buy two nukes from them. And one of them I'm going to do Langstroth system, but with without foundation. Or I can, mm-hmm, show you later. What I did was I just nailed very skinny strips of foundation so that they'll build in the frames.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to experiment with nadiring in a Langstroth hive. And I did the measurements, and my lift will, because I'm going to use an 8-frame.
Mm-hmm.
My lift will lift will an 8-frame. Yeah.
Yeah,
I just have to put, I have to build bars, handles.
Yeah.
Because the lift slides under the handle. So I'm gonna try it out. You know.
Sounds good.
We'll see how it goes. It's an experiment. And the other experiment I have is I built a transfer box, which I'll show you when we have a chance to walk around my property, to transfer bees from a Langstroth nuke into a top bar hive. Now, people know that a top bar hive, the shape of the boxes are usually trapezoidal.
Mm-hmm.
You can build what's called just a long hive, which is the same dimensions as a lang, but horizontal.
Right.
And I've never done that.
I've built double wides.
Oh, yeah.
I built two double wides. I didn't really like them because I don't like reaching across the hive to pick up a frame like that.
Oh, yeah.
So I one of them I just used to store frames in, and the other one I actually cut slots in and put little thin sheets of plywood in there, so I made 4 or 5 frame nukes out of it.
Oh, yeah, like mating nukes.
Yeah.
Well, what I did, and I don't know if it'll work, so I went onto YouTube because, you know, through all the years, people have been asking me, you know, they come to my classes, they're like, oh, the top bar seems so cool and so easy on your body as a beekeeper and so gentle on the bees, and can I just put my Langstroth bees into my top bar box? And I'd have to say, not easily. Just wait for a swarm and put the swarm in the top bar. And I went on YouTube and I looked at, you know, I think I searched for like Langstroth nuke transfer to top bar hive. And I saw people doing stuff that just looked really silly to me, like asking for it, like putting the Langstroth frames perpendicular in the top bar hive in the back. Perpendicular to the way that you would want the bees to actually build in the top bar. And I saw people painstakingly sawing the frames to fit. Now, what I did, and I should patent it, I really think it's going to work, is I basically modified a Langstroth nuke to fit on the front end of a top bar hive.
So the frames are parallel to
The bars. Frames are in the same way that the bar that the top bar paddles are going to go,
and the nuke sits.
On the front end. So basically,
you take one wall off of the nuke and attach that into.
Sort of. I took the front end off the top bar hive and I cut out that shape from one side of the nuke, and it's attached temporarily. And so my theory is that the bees will be in the nuke, and I can send you a picture. You can put a picture on your podcast. I just took pictures to show my mentees. So basically, once they've outgrown the nuke, they start building in the top bar. And once they've built out some of the top bar and the queen is laying in the top bar portion, I put a queen excluder so that she can no longer lay in the nuke. And eventually, I can just take that nuke off the front end and screw the front end of the top bar back on, and then I have my bees in the top bar hive. We'll see. What I don't know is what's going to happen with the frames in the nuke. Like, the brood will hatch out, and then they probably won't store a lot of honey in there. It'll probably just be a little band of honey and then empty frames.
Might be.
But
that's the part. Who knows?
Yeah, that's the part I don't know. But I think that what I like about it is that the bees still have a consistent experience of what they do in a top bar hive is they start in the front with a little bit of food and then brood and then honey storage in the back.
Mm-hmm.
They always will do this. Well, you know, always. From the perspective of a bee, which means
statistically speaking,
90% of the
time they'll probably do it.
Yeah, but so it seems to me like it's going to work, based on everything I know from keeping bees in top bars for 20 years. And I'll let you know, but I'll also make sure you have a picture so that people can envision it. And it really took me, you know, almost no time and very little money to set it up, just a little ingenuity. I bought a plastic queen excluder off of Amazon or something for $3 and just cut it to the proper size and made a little slot that it slides down into. So we'll see.
Great. That's as good as idea as I've ever heard.
Yeah. Because I do think, you know, buying nukes is nice. The bees, you know, I've had it with packages. I've had so many packages fail.
And that's what I've been recommending about for years. We have recommended not to buy packages because they have such a high failure rate. And I've started, when I travel around doing talks and stuff, I've started telling people, like, would you buy a car if it had a 45% chance of blowing up in October? So why would you buy a package that has a 45% chance of blowing up in October?
And that brings me to talk a little bit about treatment-free. So I think why people buy packages is because they want to get started as a beekeeper, and it's one of the ways to get started. You don't necessarily start by catching a swarm. You don't necessarily start because you know someone who's going to give you a split. So, and I think there are some package suppliers that they're good people, but they feel like they have to treat. And so what I see is that the bees are fine as long as the treatments are working. And then the treatments wear off and you want to be a treatment-free beekeeper. And then there's only a percentage of the bees whose immune system is really strong enough after those treatments wear off to make it. And I've been really talking to people for about, ever since colony collapse disorder came around, that yes, there's a thing that's called colony collapse disorder and it looks a very specific way, but there's all these other things that are prevalent in conventional beekeeping. And let me say, I don't want to ever say anything bad about any beekeeper. Including conventional beekeepers. I know there's reasons they do what they do. But I think the general public has no idea that bees are regularly treated with antibiotics and miticides, that they have manipulated cell size and manipulated genetics, and a lot of the stuff that goes down is equally as bad as in conventional agriculture. And people just don't know. They have no idea about that. So to me, you know, what I've observed is, once the mite treatments and the antibiotics wear off about 6 months in, the population crashes, the bees can't make it on their own. And I had 8 students last year who were with me for a year, and only one of them did the package survive that they bought. And this was from a woman who's doing survivor stock, supposedly treatment-free packages. But
well, the package itself, like doing a cutout, the package itself is an extremely stressful situation on bees. And if you look at when Dee Lesby came up with the idea of small cell and was trying to switch over to small cell back in the mid-80s, she thought the solution was to do shakedowns, which is basically a package.
Right.
You shake out all the bees onto a new hive and new foundation. And I believe, and there's a lot of people with me who believe that that was so much more stressful than even just leaving the bees alone would have been.
Well, they can't also immediately build on small cell. It takes them several generations before they can do that.
And I've gone through that process. I use small cell myself. Every once in a while, I'll do a poll on the Facebook group, and it's generally at this point among, you know, our 16,000 people, about 75% are foundationless, no foundation whatsoever. I would do more foundationless. I do some, but the reason why I use foundation is simply because I want to put the stuff on the hive and leave them alone and have them not have to come back and check to make sure everything's going well.
Right.
So that's why I use small cell. I'm going to be posting one of the talks that I did recently on small cell on the podcast. So you'll get my my reasoning behind all of that, but
Got it.
Foundationless is a really good option. And
well, as a top barbie keeper, that's all we know.
Exactly. You can save yourself quite a bit of money. I just noticed the Man Lake catalog this year just came, and they've raised the frame price about 10%. Foundation price is about the same, but you know, as equipment gets more expensive, as it will, I'm more and more recommending people, if they can, to build their own hives or do things like, if you're not trying to manage for production, just get a hollow log and stick that on there.
Well, one of the...
Save some money is what I'm saying.
Exactly. I will say so I bought a Langstroth hive. I went to Shastina Millworks or Shastina Bee Girls. If you walk into their store, for those of you who are local, they give you a great deal, 25% off.
I'm working. I'm saving up money to buy a pallet of boxes.
Oh, cool!
So I'm going to be. Those of you who are local, I'm going to have a lot that I will resell at a really good price,
right?
So that I can use the volume that I want and get the volume deal on it.
Yeah, I wanted to say something about foundationless and crosscomb and stuff like that. So. This is just an observation I've had because I've been a top bar beekeeper for most of my beekeeping life. And one of the critiques is that the bees can easily build crosscomb. Now, back in the early days of top bar beekeeping, people would try to attach a strip of foundation to their top bar comb guide with a bit of beeswax. And the problem with this is that a lot of times in hot weather, those strips would just fall off, and also made for a weaker attachment to the top bar comb guide. So I don't ever use foundation in my top bar hives. The time that you have to manage it is during the nectar flow. When bees are building the brood comb, they tend to, if they get started correctly, they tend to build in the center of each top bar and build straight combs. It's the mad rush. The weather warms up. There's totally a lot of resource available, and the bees go crazy building comb. This is, in my observation, when crosscomb gets built, and that's the one period. So you really have to be aware of your season and what's going on. That's the one time of the year that you have to manage your top bar hive. And it's not very long. It's like a month and a half of going in there every 7 days to make sure they're building straight. And, of course, the way that you make sure that they're building straight is you take a small unfinished comb from the very back and you put it between the last two combs that are well built. And they have to fill that in before they build more. So I rarely have crosscomb. But you can also fix crosscomb. I have an article on my website about how to fix it. I call it bracketing, which you basically bracket it in on either side with a good comb and force them to again build straight. So it's always useful to have some empty combs around from hives that have failed for doing that. But also, if they build crazy comb in the brood area, it doesn't matter. You don't have to manage in there. You just have to make sure there's a queen. There's a lot of ways to make sure there's a queen without actually disturbing the brood area. The easiest one is just if they're bringing in pollen, they're raising brood.
And the most important thing is they don't care. The comb
right.
is...
Right. For them, it doesn't matter. It's only for the convenience of the beekeeper. Mm. And if the crosscomb is in the honey area, I just wait till spring and I harvest it all out when there's plenty of nectar and get the bees to build that comb new. And so that's the deal on that is like, it is a little bit more work, but it's only a very narrow window of the year when you have to manage those hives a little bit more rigorously. And it's fun. It's fun to do.
Mm-hmm. That's what I, with my Langstroth hives, I try to do at least one foundationless frame per box. I would do more if I, you know, got into it more, but, I tend to try and minimize the number of times that I go into the hive to leave them alone and do their work. And so people,
have you tried just doing strips?
I actually do what I'll do is I'll take a frame. If it's a new frame, I'll leave the wedge where it is, you mm-hmm. know, how that comes attached.
Yeah.
And then I'll just put a bead of wood glue in there and I'll put three popsicle sticks.
Oh yeah.
So that there's a nice comb guide, and then they can attach it the best way possible, which is their way. You're right. I've heard plenty of people say that trying to melt wax or rub wax on there really doesn't help as much as you might think it would.
Right.
So I let them do all that, and then I'll put that in the middle of a box that's already drawn, so they're not going to go anywhere. And then people ask me if it's beneficial to put a drone comb in. And I just say, don't go buy a drone comb or drone foundation. Just stick foundationless in there. And generally, because of the way that Langstroth hives are managed, they'll usually draw out drone. And it's good. Throughout history, we've been kind of told that drones are lazy and a drain on resources, but that's really not the case at all. Drones are some of the hardest working bees in the hive. They fly around all day until they're exhausted.
They go hang out at the DCA.
Yeah, so it's a lot of work hovering around up there waiting for a queen to come along. So they're hard workers.
I forget, because I've never been primarily a Langstroth beekeeper, that there's no drone comb naturally in mm-hmm. And to me it's insane. I think the bees know exactly how many drones they need, and besides the fact that they fly around all day, the drones are so important. They ensure the genetic diversity and hybrid vigor of the species. That small population of drones is you know, like the mother bee, it's like the life of the hive. And if we don't allow bees to make plentiful drones, as many as they think they can quote unquote afford, then we're reducing their ability to adapt mm-hmm. and be resilient in the face of pathogens and climate change and all that.
Not only that, but with proper cell size, the drones, the more of the varroa predation is pushed off onto the drones, who can, as in the hive, can afford to lose more drones because they don't contribute to the inner workings of the hive so much.
Right.
And so they're kind of like the sacrificial.
Aww.
Yeah. So it's kind of sad, but that's how nature works.
One of the, we were talking a little bit about Jacqueline Freeman. Hi, Jacqueline. One of the things I loved in her book was that when she talks about foundation and foundationless, is that this idea that foundation doesn't transmit sound as well as natural comb, and that the bees actually communicate across a resonating chamber in their natural comb, whereas with the plastic foundation, it interrupts that ability to communicate. And, you know, I don't know if there's any science behind it, but it makes a sort of sense to me that the natural comb is very thin and light, and the foundation, when I got my Langstroth box, is like this heavy, thick black stuff.
Wax foundation is thicker than the normal midrib of the comb.
Yeah,
the bees do kind of chew that out a little bit, but I think it still ends up being a little thicker. But then plastic definitely is much thicker and has totally different characteristics to wax.
Yep.
So that makes sense. I haven't heard that there's any scientific research on that, but it makes sense.
Yeah. What else?
What else? Let's see. We talked about your adapter. What time are we at? We're at 53 minutes, so we're doing pretty well.
Yeah.
I love it. I can always tell when I'm doing an interview, like when I ask the first question, like if the person takes like 5 or 10 minutes to introduce themselves, I know that it's going to be a good day for me.
Oh, good.
If they
you hate a short interview.
Yeah. If they introduce themselves in like a minute and a half, I know I'm going to have to do a lot more work. So it's good.
Well, I'm glad to give you an easy day. I could talk about bees, you know, really literally for hours. In the classes I teach, I really focus on biology, taxonomy, life cycle, That's what I wanted to say before, the difference between a beehaver and a beekeeper. Mm-hmm. So to me, what defines you as a beekeeper is, okay, this will just expose me as a bibliophile, is how much you've read and studied.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you are less of a beekeeper because you don't touch your bees and manipulate them. But I think that if you don't study the animal and try to really understand it and understand their life cycles and what they're doing, there's no way you can support them when there is an emergency.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think, even as treatment-free beekeepers, that there are things that we can and should do to help our bees out. I think that we need to think about combining weak hives, for example, before the winter, so they have a better chance of making it. Some people might disagree with me. I think it's important to watch the buildup and nectar flow. I don't like to feed my bees. I think that honey is the perfect food for bees, but in an emergency situation, I will feed them. And I have a special bee elixir formula that I use, not just straight sugar water.
What do you use?
It's basically an herbal tea,
mm-hmm.
Often with lemongrass, which we know mimics the queen pheromone, and some mint and some sage in there, and some garlic and some vitamin C to lower the pH. So it's an immune system booster. And for those of you who don't know, the pH of sugar actually encourages pests and pathogens and disrupts the natural fauna and flora. So when you start talking about immune systems, just like in our gut, the inside of the bee box is full of different microorganisms that support the bees, that work in partnership with them. And so sugar can really disrupt those microorganisms. So I try to give them something that is going to be less disruptive and also immune system boosting. And of course, if you're without a queen or your population is low, giving them brood is, I think, you know, it's a good thing to do, to save them if you can. And
The quickest and easiest way to save a queenless hive, unless you want to develop the trait of thalidiki, which we can talk about, is a very, very obscure thing that I've discovered. But the best thing you can do to save a hive that's having any sort of problem at all is by adding a frame or bar of brood every week until the problem fixes itself. Either they build a new queen or supersede the old queen or whatever.
Yep.
And that's one of the main reasons why I recommend people don't just keep one or two hives, is because when you have, say, five, you've got a really good chance of being able to keep five, whereas if you have one or two, you have a really good chance of losing one or both of them at the same time, which is unfortunate.
Speaking of, I don't know if it was like this up here, but last year there were so many failed queens.
Really?
It was crazy. My bees and the bees of my students just kept trying to replace queens, and the queens were just crappy. We had a weird false spring.
This was back down in Oakland?
This was in Oakland, but I heard about it in other places too. And so lots of laying workers last year. And the problem, of course, is, you know, if you catch your laying workers soon enough, you can give them brood once a week and eventually they will build a queen. But sometimes it's too late. The population has gone too low.
Takes a while, yeah.
You
got to suppress the workers first before they will make a new queen.
Right.
So that can take a couple of weeks.
Correct. And what new beekeepers might not know is it is not the queen that suppresses the worker bee's ability to lay eggs. It is the brood pheromone.
That's correct, yeah.
So you need to have open brood in the hive. So that's why it takes a few weeks after a queen is lost to actually see laying workers, because the brood that's there will inhibit them.
Mm-hmm.
We saw a lot of that last year. I had many, like more than I've almost ever had, of incidences of the bees trying to make a new queen and the new queen failing and laying workers.
I had up here, I made a bunch of queens last spring. I think I came out with 28.
Woohoo.
And tried and put together nukes for all of those. And I had most of them mated, probably 70%. And different areas have a different percentage of what you'll be, what your return will be. But after that, the conditions were such that very few of those nukes were able to build up and do anything throughout the summer. It was just a really harsh summer. There's a commercial beekeeper over in the Applegate Valley who told me that he lost something like 40% of his hives, which if you work out the numbers, is something like 300 hives that he lost during the summer. So it was really harsh here this summer.
Was that because of hot weather, or was it because of mites? Or
I think what happened was we had a really good rain throughout the spring, and then it just stopped immediately. Like now, right now we're getting this is a wetter than normal winter, so the rainy period is stretching out even longer than normal. But this is fairly normal as far as. It'll rain in the wintertime. It's pretty wet here, but then it'll keep raining sporadically into the spring until it finally stops in May or so. And I think what happened last year is it rained like heavily up until say the end of March. I don't remember the exact dates, but then it just cut off.
Yeah.
Immediately.
So no food.
And so after the blackberry bloom, there was nothing.
Yeah.
And so I was making my nukes during the blackberry bloom, which is a good time to do it here. And so everything worked fairly well. We were having really nice weather for making nukes and queens and stuff. And after that, it just all died. And so I lost most of the nukes that I made, and it just was a rough year. And since I don't feed very much, and I didn't feed at all this last summer, only the very tip top of that batch of queens made it through.
Hold on to that genetic.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, down in California, there was some stuff going around that really made me mad. I think that a lot of the populations collapsed because of mites. And there was a bunch of beekeepers, even ones that usually promote natural beekeeping, who were shaming any treatment-free beekeepers for not treating for mites. And they were promoting the use of MiteX, which is oxalic acid treatment. But they basically said, if you're not treating your bees for mites, you're killing everyone else's bees.
Mm-hmm.
So serious shaming.
The old mite bomb.
And, you know, I was mentoring some folks, and they were all writing to me and saying, like, really? Shouldn't we treat? And I said, you know, you can do what you want to. But if we continue to treat for mites, the bees are never going to build resistance to them. And, you know, interestingly, that whole thing of, you know, the Americans said you couldn't breed a mite-resistant bee, and then the Russians went and did it, and there's several different strains. And
the Russians went and did it 80 years ago.
Right. So, you know, I just didn't appreciate that. It made me feel crappy, and I think it made my students feel really crappy and insecure. And even somebody was saying, well, they tell their first year beekeepers to treat because they don't want people to go through the disappointment of losing their bees. And I had both happen amongst my students. I had some people just be really discouraged and give up. And then I had, you know, over half of the people say, okay, we're trying again. And we're going to try to catch swarms and, you know, bees, feral bees that are doing well. So
that's exactly what I teach. Like when you're working with swarms and when you know how to catch swarms, you have a much more optimistic outlook on things because you're not so worried about losing the bees that you are tempted to treat, because we know the philosophy and the science behind it and why it works and why we do what we do works. So that's why I recommend catching swarms so much. But we also, in the position that we're in, I'm realizing more and more these days that we have to become students of the human condition. I just finished reading a new book that's out by Bassem Youssef called Revolution for Dummies, and it's about how the Arab Spring went down in Egypt.
Right.
And he was known as the John Stewart of the Nile, or John Stewart. He kind of crafted that all himself. He's a funny guy. Anyway, toward the end of the book, he's talking about how his staff of writers and stuff, they've been satirizing the Egyptian government for 3 years at this point. And the Egyptian military came out with this, basically they said, we've come up with the cure for cancer and AIDS. Just an outlet. If you're familiar with the science and medicine, like, it's an outlandish claim. But all these people who had been satirizing the Egyptian government and the military for years, when the military came out with this ridiculous proclamation, everybody went, oh, do you think they could be right? It's like, listen to yourself. You know how this all works. And yet, because the claim got so outlandish, it went around from unbelievable back to believable again. Mm-hmm. Like, the lie got so big that it came back around to believable again. Mm-hmm. And if you've been following the Facebook group lately, somebody yesterday posted an article that had been written that kind of...
Oh, yeah, that's one of the ones.
That, yeah, talked about me and quoted a bunch of my stuff, mostly out of context and selectively. But, and I just was thinking about it, in to say at this point that treatment-free beekeeping doesn't work is like saying airplanes can't fly. Like, there was a point in time where that was an accepted wisdom, and that was just, everybody knew that. But at this point, we know airplanes can fly. Some of us have flown on one.
Well, and then it's what about to that what level. About the what is it, 200 million years of bees being on the planet before humans, you know?
Yeah,
they didn't have any treatments then, I don't think.
And no, and the feral population is doing just fine.
Yeah,
I've been keeping bees totally treatment free, more strictly than almost anybody else, for 14 years. Like, at this point, it literally makes as much sense as saying that heavier than airships don't fly. It's just, I mean, we've done it. We've done it for a long time, and it works.
And
And just yes, we do have setbacks sometimes, yeah. But nature, the story of nature is cyclic.
Exactly.
In a competition between pest and prey and weather, and it goes in cycles. And so this really, I mean, it is tough for us as humans to be concerned about this stuff, but this really is normal.
If you talk to real old-timer beekeepers, they will tell you that before colony collapse disorder, before treating bees, before this whole thing went down, that every 10 to 15 years there'd be a die-off.
Hmm?
There'd be a big cycle of die-off, and then the bees would build themselves back up, and they're just incredibly resilient.
And you'll see that. You'll have a pretty harsh year, and you can theorize that you're having a harsh year. And the way you'll know is the next year you'll see a big reduction in the swarms that you'll catch. This last year was pretty harsh, but I'm still catching plenty of swarms, it seems, so.
Okay. I haven't heard of any out here yet, but,
yeah, you might be a little cooler than, down where I am.
One thing I didn't
actually
share
up
is
where I am from here.
When I, first saw this property, so we have a feral colony living free air in our barn.
Great.
And,
wow. I gotta see that.
That's yeah. Cool. Unfortunately, I'll have to show you in a picture because what I did, because I wanted to use my barn, was I built a box around them in the mm-hmm. dead of winter. So they're still in there, but they're in a box. There was apparently this area of the barn had been colonized a number of times because there was a bunch of old comb in there attached in various places, and I've now taken that down, but I can show you pictures. I'm excited for when these bees are going to swarm because they've been here a long time and they were living, my God, I mean, in the barn, but basically open air with their comb just hanging out off the wall of the barn.
Open air hives are so cool.
Very cool. I have some rare, nice pictures of it, and it was amazing to build around them. So I built, it was probably 37 degrees, and the bees were way up in the corner of their comb there. You can't really call it a hive, I guess. And they just hummed at me the whole time I was like doing, you know, construction around them with plywood and a cordless drill and all this stuff. It was pretty amazing. And of course, if you poke their heads out, they couldn't fly. It was just too cold. But it was a really, really interesting experience. Anyway, I know we're almost out of time.
We can go as long as you want. I don't want to take too much of your time.
Well, I did think of something else that just people might find interesting.
Mm-hmm.
To share, and that is that I am a beekeeper that is allergic.
Really?
And my journey with my bee allergy has been really, really interesting. So I thought I'd just take a moment to share a little
bit. Please, yeah.
When I started beekeeping, I wasn't allergic. I would get stung and I would have the local reaction, just, you know, stings a little and then gets a little swelling. And I had an old-time beekeeper tell me I should get stung once a month regularly, and that would build my resistance. And the stings would get less and less annoying. Well, that beekeeper didn't really have a global understanding of how bodies function. And so you can go either way. Mm-hmm. You can either build resistance, or you can get a cascading histamine response. And this is what happened to me. I was beekeeping or managing a top bar hive one day, a little bit too late in the day. It was a little cool. I was trying to close up the hive, and four or five bees flew up my pant leg and stung me. And I went down. I felt like I had to throw up, poop my pants, got nauseous, hot and cold flashes. And then this went on for three or four hours, and then I got hives all over my body. So this was a full-blown systemic. I did not feel like my throat was going to close, but I was pretty screwed up and pretty scared. And so what happened, as an herbalist explained to me, is that my body went the other way, and I got a cascading histamine response. It wasn't the bee sting so much that I was reacting to. It was my own histamine reaction. And I've had experiences over the year of taking a swig of Benadryl and feeling the Benadryl and the bee venom sort of duking it out in my system for who's going to win. So after that, I bought a good suit. And I worked really hard for many, many years to not be stung. And I still work pretty hard to not be stung. I'm one of those beekeepers that just has to wear a suit and gloves because I can't afford to go down for 7 hours. But about 3 years ago, I had the experience that I was over at someone else's house. I didn't have any of my Benadryl or anything with me. And we were just looking at their hives, and a bee bonked into me and stung me on my forehead. And I didn't have anything, and I felt the reaction coming. And his wife was a homeopathist. And so they gave me like a medical grade homeopathic remedy, the Apis mellifica. And boom, the reaction completely stopped. And I'm not a believer. I think homeopathy is magic, and it can't possibly work. But over the 3 years since then, I've been taking this high medical grade, you know, it's 1000X or something, which
actually, if you understand homeopathy,
right, it has 0% in it. Like, who knows? So it could be, what is that called? The placebo effect. I don't know. I still carry an EpiPen. I still carry Benadryl, but I have found when I take the homeopathy that it knocks it right down.
Well, that's very interesting. I had this revelation this last year, because I was, maybe it was the year before, because I was concerned about telling people buy honey from me all the time, looking for local honey. Well, I
for allergy
for relief. Allergies. Yeah. I don't have any local honey since I've moved to Oregon because I still have all my honey from Arkansas, and I've been building hives rather than making honey at this point.
Gotcha.
But even back in Arkansas, I was concerned about telling people that honey works for allergies because there have been a couple of studies on it, and they've been pretty firmly in the camp of
it doesn't help.
Mm-hmm. But I heard a podcast, and I'm struggling to remember which one, that was about the nature of the placebo effect and how in about 30% of the population, the placebo effect is extremely strong, and it works even when people know that they're just eating a placebo or taking a sugar pill. And so I changed my understanding from this doesn't work to a more scientifically accurate position, which is it works as well as placebo. Because placebo, in a number of cases, does actually work.
Well, power of prayer, right?
That too. So it started, I mean, that was just this huge revelation for me, because I can give people, how do I say this without, I'm a very honest person. I don't want to lie to anybody.
Right.
But depending on how the question's asked, I can give them the information they're looking for without being dishonest, but still give them the remedy that if they believe it works, it will work. And allergies is one of those things that it works particularly well, because it's really a reaction of your body overreacting to an external stimulus. And if you can, in some way, your body, through whatever mechanism, it's not understood well at this point, can take control of the problem on your own and deal with the problem on your own simply by believing you're taking medicine, then so much the better. Let's give people that remedy if it works for them.
Sure. And I mean, maybe it is the placebo effect with me. I know that I've believed for most of my life that I have a rock solid immune system.
I also believe that.
I almost never get a cold. Like, I'll go 3 years. I have a little bit of a sore throat at the moment, but I don't believe I'm going to get a full-blown sickness. And I do see, like, friends who are so anxious and worried and know they're going to get sick. They do. And I know that there's more to it than that. But yeah, I mean, I believe that I'm going to be healthy, and so I mostly am. And so, yeah, I guess there's no science for that, but...
Well,
but I guess belief and science are getting closer and closer.
Yeah, it depends on who you talk to.
Right.
I'm very much an empiricist, which means that I believe that we need evidence for things to prove things. But I'm also very open-minded to spiritual explanations of things, with the understanding that there is a scientific explanation behind a lot of spiritual things.
Right.
And people choose to believe the spiritual explanation for it, and that's fine. Whatever works, like that's what my philosophy with beekeeping these days is whatever kind of hive you like, whatever you want to do, if it works, then do it.
Right.
I don't think we should judge people based on the understanding that they have of something. I think we can all really be on the same page, even if we're not all on the same page.
I get your drift.
Which is why I can, you know, even like we saw some people yesterday had some kind of disparaging things about Jacqueline. Like, I don't necessarily follow Jacqueline's more spiritual approach to beekeeping, but I can understand how that works for her and how that gives her the same results with the bees as I get. because it really doesn't matter what the explanation for it is. And the same thing with treatment-free, with dealing with mites and other diseases. It doesn't really matter to me what the trait or traits or the ways that the bees deal with mites. It just matters that they deal with mites. Mm-hmm. I leave it totally up to them. And I'm kind of rambling here, but this is kind of still developing. You know, I'm still sort of a young guy. I'm still coming up with
what?
All the stuff. I don't feel as old as I am. I really don't. I think I'm about 24.
Oh, I think that happens to lots of us. My mom was always saying that. I was like, I look in the mirror and my image of myself doesn't fit how I feel inside.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good thing.
I've gone through big changes in my life philosophically in the last 3 years. So I feel like I'm a new, approaching the world from an entirely different, entirely new perspective. So yeah. It's fun.
Well, I'm feeling like I've said most of what I want to say. Do you have anything else you wanted to ask me or follow up about?
I don't. I'm interested in going outside and looking at all the stuff. And
yeah.
Because I love this property. Just to paint a word picture, we're in this nice house, and there's been hummingbirds coming to visit your plants in the front yard while we've been talking.
Oh yeah, and they do get out here at the feeder too.
Yeah, and you're a plant person. I'm a plant person. In your front window here, you've got a bunch of plants and some betta fish with plants growing in their bowls there. And if you saw my house, like I've got like maybe 24 potted plants, and some of them are quite large, like across my windows.
Well, you're going to see our collections. We have several, probably 4 or 5 different propagation areas here.
Awesome.
We have a collection of probably 50 to 70 different types of roses, about 200 kinds of dahlias, lots of stuff propagating for fruit trees, and then lots of critters, birds and chickens and rabbits and sheep and cows and
cats. This is a very picturesque. I mean, we're looking out, there's like foot tall green grass for, you know, the nearest quarter, eighth of a mile or so. And then beyond that are evergreen wooded hills.
Yeah.
So it's really nice.
It captured my imagination.
Great. Well, let's finish this up and then we'll go check all that out.
All right. Well, I just wanted to mention that.
Give us your website and your books.
Yep. So I don't have a bee book out yet, but one day I hope to write something about alternative beekeeping. I have a informational bee website that's called beerepair.com. And that has a lot of articles on top bar hives, alternative hives, crosscomb, just stuff related to alternative hive beekeeping. I also started a new educational project here in Southern Oregon. It's called Rogue River Reskilling. Old world skills for a new world culture. So teaching a lot of different homesteading and ag skills. And two books I have out. One is just called Urban Homesteading, Heirloom Skills for Sustainable Living, co-authored with another friend of mine. You can find that on Amazon or anywhere. And I also have a little book on cheesemaking called Everyday Cheesemaking, How to Succeed Making Dairy and Nut Cheeses at Home. So those are my calling cards. And if you go to any website of mine, please send me a line, say hello, ask me about beehives. I love to talk to people online, and I'm really appreciative that you asked me for an interview. It's fun.
Great. I'm so glad I came out here. I'm much happier that I came out here rather than have you stop by my place, because like this is really awesome to be out here.
Yeah, and now we get to like look around at all the bees and the plants and the critters here.
Yeah, let's go take the tour.
Awesome.
Here's my catchphrase I was talking about earlier.
All right, I'm waiting.
Have fun keeping bees, because if you're not having fun, you probably shouldn't do it.
That's awesome.